Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority. But to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. Obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one compliance solution helping startups get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. Vanta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. The platform connects you with trusted experts to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vanta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including Y Combinator and Techstar startups, who trust Vanta. For a limited time, get $1,000 off Vanta at vanta.com/simplify. That's vanta.com/simplify for $1,000 off.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we have the happy pleasure today of talking over the offense from that win over the Bengals in Cincinnati on Sunday. Joining me to do that is Jonas Schaefer of the Baltimore Banner. Jonas, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken. Great to be back on.
Always a pleasure. If you don't read Jonas's work at the Banner, you should. People probably remember him from The Sun and how good he was, and very technical, adding a kind of another layer to the coverage there. And I always get a very thoughtful, cerebral kind of discussion whenever he's on. I always appreciate having him on. So Jonas, one of the people that I enjoy from around camp. I always seem to find myself in a discussion a day, at least with him, watching the sideline. And he's very, very studious about writing down the plays the same way that I like to be. Always ends up being a fun discussion. But Jonas, appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, of course. Glad to dig in into incredible game that we've got ourselves, and unfortunately we've got the fun part of the diagnosis, not the ugly part.
Yeah, it's, even the ugly part had enough fun that it was good, but it would have been a very dark discussion if the Ravens had lost on the 53-yard field goal. There would have been a completely different discussion, and that's just the way it is. We watched this game. And this is something that reminds me a lot of the 2003 game against Seattle. I know you grew up in Silver Spring, but you're considerably younger, so you probably would have been, 12 or 14 in 2003?
Yep, 13.
13, okay. So anyway, maybe you don't remember the game, or maybe you do anyway, but the 44-41, great comeback win from 17 down. And it was just the same kind of cadence to the game where neither offense could be stopped in the second half, and they were each scoring pretty much at will. And it was very frustrating for Ravens fans because it was most of the game, it was between down 17 and down 10 that the game was altering that time. This game, it was really down 10 and down 3 were the major stopping points in the second half. But incredible comeback, and I so thoroughly enjoyed this game in terms of the ability to get a big stop when they needed to, certainly on defense, but the fact that the offense never took the foot off the pedal at any point in that second half.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the touchdown, just because of my experience on the beat, was the 2021 game against the Colts, where it wasn't as much a, punch, counterpunch type game. That one, that was the game where the Ravens couldn't stop Jonathan Taylor, couldn't stop Michael Pittman, especially in the first half. The third quarter, they get rolling in the fourth quarter, and it's just a blitzkrieg from Lamar. I think especially the comparison rings true for me for that one, because that was a Colts secondary that got progressively more banged up, and you had a Bengals secondary in this one that was obviously missing Mike Hilton. Then they lose Dax Hill early. not a good defense to start with. So you start to see things snowball and Lamar take charge in the second half, the way that he did in the second half of that game, 2021 week five. So for me, it was, you know, obviously different in that that was a primetime game. Everyone was just, you know, tuned in. Everyone was wrapped by that game. I think this still probably got tens of millions of viewers on CBS, but obviously, it, you know, not being an island game was maybe a little bit more hidden from view, but that was the game that, you know, without thinking about it too hard, was the one that rang for me as the most analogous to what we saw there in Cincinnati on Sunday.
I'd agree. That's another very good one. They were down, what, 22-3, 25-6. I still remember them being down 19 in that game against the Colts. Came back with a couple of two-point conversions. They had a blocked field goal in there. I mean, there were so many events in there. But Andrews caught, I think, both touchdowns and both two-point conversions, if I recall correctly. And I don't remember who caught the winning score in overtime.
Hollywood Brown.
Okay. All right. Well, that was certainly a great one. And I think that might be the only time the Ravens have won by scoring a touchdown on the first drive of overtime. I don't remember it happening otherwise anyway. Might have, but I just don't remember it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was also maybe the last time Carson Wentz was good. That was a 25 for 35 for 402 yards.
There you go. You know, the one of the things about this game that probably unleashed as much profanity, and I will just tell you, watching this game at home with Maureen, my USDA profanity requirements for the day were more than met. I'll just say this was a game where I was screaming at the screen all day. And, one of the tantrums that was let out was after the 70-yard screen pass to Chase, of course, where I don't know that there were really missed tackles per se on the play, but there were some very bad angles and some, you know, obviously any kind of difficulty corralling and him beyond that initial kind of box he was in space was fairly futile by Williams. But the thing that really came out is that play may have really helped the Ravens win this game in a perverse way, because the Bengals were on the field for one offensive play. The Ravens had two long drives sandwiching it. And, you know, it was a very tired Bengals defense. And you can see it in the body language. You can see it in some of the post-play emotion, particularly after the Lamar touchdown, I think it's Pratt on the sideline who just is, it gives you this I give up gesture kind of thing. As much as this has been a problem for the Ravens, certainly the Cowboys game, the big comeback was 24 out of 27 straight snaps. The defense had to be on the field. I think that was a big part of this play. And I look at that Chase touchdown. I'm like, that really wasn't worth 7 points to them. It was worth something less than 7 points, but it wasn't worth a full 7 points to them in that situation.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think, you know, obviously history is written by the victors. And so anytime you go into a winning locker room and you ask, especially offensive linemen, about the other team being worn down by them, they are more than happy to toot their own horn and say that, yes, you know, that is indeed what happened. A little bit of a reversal. Reversal is a funny word in this context, but like, I'm not sure if you saw Ken, you know, in the aftermath of that game, you know, when we're in the locker room, we're talking to guys, Ronnie Stanley was, you know, as he usually is, the one of the last guys to talk. He takes a while to get ready, takes a while to shower off, cool down, all that good stuff. But he missed. He was not on the field for the Lamar to likely touchdown because he was puking his guts out. Because
I didn't know that.
I don't think it had as much to do with the heat. You know, I think it was like 85 degrees there in Cincinnati. You know, it's beaten off the turf, so you get that, you know, microwave effect where it's even worse than what it might look like on the thermometer. But he got kneed or elbowed or kicked or something in the gut, and he just could not keep any food down. So he told us, like, you know, those snaps where Josh Jones went in, that was him on the bench puking his guts out. And, you know, I think it didn't really matter to your point, because the Ravens at that point were kind of rolling the snowball downhill, and there wasn't a whole lot that Cincinnati could do to get a second wind. I mean, I think it was a very smart use by Todd Monken. I think, you know, midway through that fourth quarter to go to no huddle and just continue to put Cincinnati on the back foot. I think, you know, the
great point.
I forget if it was the touchdown drive right after Chase or right before Chase, where they used no huddle a couple times to get some nice easy first downs. But you know, I think Todd Monken really did a good job of pushing the buttons. And you know, at a certain point, even though this season is what, only 5 weeks old, you know, the cumulative effect of being in as many high scoring shootouts as Cincinnati has, I think it definitely has, you know, taken its toll on that defense. And certain guys who maybe aren't used to playing as much as they had to in this one probably got worn down in a way that, you know, Zach Taylor wouldn't have liked.
10 no huddle snaps in that fourth quarter. So that would very much underscore your point there. And they definitely dominated snap count. One of the things is kind of interesting to me, and I always think gambling markets will give you a lot of information about things. And the Ravens were still the favorite to win the AFC North, even when they were 0-2. I'm actually surprised that they're only a 71.4% chance to win the division now. And somebody might look at that and say, well, that's, you know, 5 out of 7. So, you know, they're 5-2 favorites or something like that. That's not what it is. That's taking out the juice from all the best prices on every team. They had just happened to work out to be 71.4%. Also, very surprising to me, it's that low. And the two teams that have the other share, and the Browns only have about 1% of that. But the two teams that have the significant other share are the Bengals, who still have about a 9% shot, according to you know, the betting markets, and the Steelers, who are still at about 19. How would you handicap this race as you're looking at it right now?
It's interesting that it's 71.4, because first of all, where's that number taken from? Is that just you doing the math of what the
odds are? I have to do the math, but I take the best price on all of the four teams. I plug that into a spreadsheet and I figure out what are the total implied odds. And it's usually over 100%, because the betting markets have naturally some juice in there for the house. And it ends up being, when you look at the best price from a cross section of books, it ends up only being about 1.4, 1.5% of total juice. And then you take that out, you factor out that, and you're then left with the underlying imputed odds for those teams winning.
Right. I asked just because on ESPN, you know, they have their football power index, which is obviously, yep, you know, sourced with a lot of their very impressive quants that they have there. And, you know, the Ravens division title odds are 71.1%. So only fractions of a point that separate the implied betting odds from what ESPN's football power index has. I'm bullish on Cincinnati having a chance to make a comeback, because I was, you know, looking at the FTN DVOA stuff, and according to their, you know, kind of future casts of what is ahead for Cincinnati, Cincinnati has the worst schedule, the easiest schedule in the NFL over the final 13 weeks. So that is definitely going to help their case. Obviously, this is all, you know, very small sample size, beware type caveats apply here. The Ravens, actually, despite all the doomsayers who are like, oh, how are the Ravens going to be able to, you know, repeat last year's success with this brutal schedule right now? Even though obviously the first 5 weeks have been, you know, very, very difficult in unexpected ways and expected ways, looking at you, Gardner Minshew and Josh Allen, they only have the 22nd hardest schedule over the rest of the season. Pittsburgh, not altogether too different. They're 18th. So maybe that is playing somewhat into those odds. Just the fact that they, you know, have retired right now. The strength of schedules aren't that different, but yeah. It's definitely a little confounding. I don't spend a lot of time looking at the betting markets other than just, you know, doing my job of looking at what the spread is, looking at what the over under is. So I don't really know what kind of, you know, big factors would go into all this, but just considering what the state of the teams are, and you know, the fact that the Ravens and the Bengals have the two best quarterbacks, and only one of those teams has a winning record, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But you know, I think if you had given the Ravens fans, you know, before the season, told them that there would be a 71% chance of them winning the division, I think most most guys probably would have liked that, considering, you know, very smart football people were picking the Bengals to be an outright Super Bowl team, but in late August, early September.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think most people would have taken it. Let's move on a little bit and talk about the penalties in the game. It's nice to see. First of all, nice to see a loosely called game. I think that's generally going to favor the Ravens, who, you know, a hard-hitting defensive team. Both teams had one roughing the passer called against them. I thought both of them were crap. It is true, right? Nobody. I mean, both of them were actually very similar takedowns, in my opinion. But did you see it any differently?
I didn't go back and look at those specifically. It seems like Nnamdi, doesn't it feel like he's been flagged for more than two this year? Maybe it's I think he's had two 15 yarders or maybe three, but it seems like when he's penalized, it is usually the most severe infractions, and also yep. They happen to be very, very ill-timed. But I confess I didn't look at the legality or lack thereof of the roughing the passer penalties.
Okay. So anyway, 21 to 24 in yardage. The Ravens, they probably needed a plus three game. I think they've sent a lot of material to the league. It wouldn't surprise me if there have been discussions. I'm not saying they want to direct the thought of officials prior to a game, but it wouldn't surprise me if there have been some point of emphasis type discussions on certainly the illegal formation, because that was part of the ones that get going on. I mean, that's been... They've stopped that crusade after two games, actually, in week one. It was really the Baltimore and the Cleveland game were the only two they were calling it in. Right. And then since then, they really haven't been going back and doing a bunch of that, not any more than they were in past years. And then really, I would say it's a lot of the personal foul type stuff. And obviously, they had some pass interference calls against the Ravens. It wouldn't surprise me if they had a highlight reel that they talked about among officiating groups that they could, you know, basically show an example of a Ravens player having a pass interference call that wouldn't potentially have an impact on this. And now you and I were there this summer when they brought in Cleet Blakeman to talk to us about the new yep. kickoff. And then they also were talking to us about the hip drop tackle rule. What did we see on that highlight reel? Do you remember the main thing? I'm not trying to stump you here. We saw two Ravens fouls or two Ravens plays, and we didn't see the Andrews play. The Andrews play wasn't on the highlight reel. Walker. And
that was the confusing thing because, the only question that I asked at that presser was, so was in fact the Mark Andrews play a hip yep. drop tackle? Because the report, the big rule change came at the NFL owners meetings. And, you know, if you're a reporter, you're there typically to talk to the team officials and then get out before all the, you know, NFL rulemaking actually happens. And so I was out of Orlando or wherever it was before, you know, they made those big sweeping changes. And I think somebody had asked, I'm blanking on the NFL official who's in charge of this stuff or who's the face of this stuff, like whether Andrews was in fact a hip drop tackle. And the reporting, I think, out of Orlando was that it wasn't. And so it was unclear to me whether the guy who would become the face of the hip drop tackle was in fact tackled legally. But Cleet Blakeman said that actually, yes. And he seemed pretty certain that would have been a hip drop tackle. So I guess it was good to have clarity on that, because we were going to write an article like this guy who, you know, had become, you know, the unwitting face of this very controversial rule change was actually a, you know, malapropism, if I'm using that word correctly, you know, that it wasn't actually, he shouldn't be the face of this because nothing that people are saying about this rule actually had anything to do with how Mark Andrews was hurt. But in fact, that was not the case.
Right. I think Cleet came across as an extremely genuine official who basically is going to call his own game and doesn't really like a lot of instruction from the league on how to do that. That's the impression I get just from that brief interaction with him. I mean, obviously, you know, he was, I think, struggling along with some of the officials to learn the kickoff rules, because they're fairly complex in terms of, you know, where things go, what happens, whatnot. But they've done a good job. I don't think there have been mistakes in applying the rules so far, but at least none that I'm aware of. But I also felt like, you know, one of the questions he was asked was about having permanent officials or full-time officials. And he said, well, yeah, they tried that, but there were some problems with it. And of course, he's not that. He's a personal injury lawyer from Omaha, as he told us, you know, that day. And I thought that was very interesting, because it's clearly he's not going to tell the full story of why it doesn't make any sense to have full-time officials. He's just saying that there's a whole lot of really talented people who are already officials in the NFL who also have other jobs.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, what leagues are there that even have full-time officials? I guess with the NBA, would baseball be? Would it just be the more high-volume sports? Because I'm thinking of like...
Oh, baseball, you know, for sure.
Basketball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And probably basketball also, because when you have that many games per year, that's enough to fund the salary. I think, you know, like Steratore and others were doing college and pro. No, that might not be true. I may be off. He was doing basketball and football at the same time, but I don't think he was doing basketball for the NBA. And so the NBA probably has officials that are full time, because I think it'd be difficult to do a job, but it's a good thing to look up. I can hear you doing it.
Yeah. The NBA has 74 full time refs. Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on a little bit. I did think, by the way, clearly do not understand what the replay assistant is for, that they could not get involved with the Mark Andrews foul. I thought like spotting fouls like that was something they were able to help with, but maybe it's only spotting that something was not a foul when it was flagged that way on the field. But anyway,
this is from the Bengals game last year.
I thought it was from this last game, or maybe I'm thinking of Buffalo, the face mask foul on the sideline. He
must've missed that.
Yeah. So it was obvious, and you know, on the replay, it's fairly obvious, and he was calling for it and not getting, and he hardly had any catches in the Buffalo game, right? So I think it was in the Bengals game.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I mean, this was his first game with a catch since week 2.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Devontae Adams, the Ravens, the betting favorite, I was told, and at the station today, which surprises me, but it's all obviously a case of the Edgar Allan Poe thing. Any credence in the notion that the Ravens might get Adams?
I don't think at this point it's very likely. I mean, and obviously I'm not as well sourced as some of the big time insiders on the national level, but you know. I guess Jay Glazer, who you know, is well connected to All National Matters, I think went on the Dan Lebatard show on Monday, and they asked him about the Edgar Allan Poe stuff. And, you know, I think he hadn't even seen it because he's not on social media, and he said it's not going to happen. So I think logically it makes sense that they would be hands off, considering just the guys coming up this pipeline that they have to pay, and just the whole ethos of this Ravens front office. I understand the compulsion to make a big swing, and I think it would be definitely really fun to see this offense, this running offense in 11 personnel, where you're getting these light boxes for Derrick Henry, and you know, you're just kind of spreading things out and giving teams a different look. But I mean, it's not just the, what, you know, $13, $14 million of salary this year. It's probably also a handshake agreement that you're going to take on however many millions of dollars after you probably restructure the deal for next year, maybe the year after that. And then where does that leave you with finding money for Tyler Linderbaum, for Kyle Hamilton, for Travis Jones, exactly, for Odafe Owe? I mean, it's just
likely
the list goes on and on.
Yeah, it's a very long list, and that's exactly the right point, is that the Ravens don't have enough money to pay all their internal stars. And this is the key. This is the key element to me, is their internal stars, particularly Linderbaum, who is in a year early signing mode, and likely, and Jones. There's somebody else I'm forgetting too. But it's not Hamilton. Hamilton would be, they still have a year early, a year from now. Because of the fifth year option, but Linderbaum, they can't really give the fifth year option to, because they have to pay him left tackle money to do it. So it doesn't, even though they're drafting the same year, it doesn't really work this as well. But the point is that when you have a chance to sign the guys early with the visible benefit on the table, you really want to take advantage of that option then and not go and pay market price. And I mean full market price and auction market price potentially for Davante Adams. It's not at all the only problem I have with the deal, because I think the whole notion that Adams is hurt until he gets to a new team, which I don't know if it's true or not, but I don't like it. I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. To have a player who says, "Yeah, I'll play as soon as I'm traded to a new team," kind of thing. Not my kind of guy.
I know, and you know, we talked about my podcast host Paul and I talked about this on our kind of Thursday show last week, but just so much of this stuff, so much of his production is tough to separate from the circumstances and the context of him having Aaron Rodgers for some years and then him having Derek Carr for 1 year and then him having Aiden O'Connell last year. But like every single year since, I think, 2019, 2020, his yards per route run has fallen off. His what else fell off? Like his
yards per target,
open score for his open score on, you know, the ESPN receiver tracking metrics has fallen off. You know, I think like 2021 or 2022, he was eighth or something in the NFL among wide receivers. Last year it was 16th. This year it's 20th. So, you know, could some of that be changed with a change of scenery? Absolutely. I always come back to just how pessimistic I was about Jadeveon Clowney doing anything of note in Baltimore. And then he gets here and just looks like a borderline Pro Bowl player. And, you know, maybe that could be a similar turnaround for someone like Devontae if he were to come into Baltimore and, you know, learn to love Lamar like everyone who comes to Baltimore learns to love Lamar. But, you know, at a certain point, aging receivers are just not a kind of asset you want in your books. I mean, I think there are only four, I think I looked up like only four NFL receivers since Lamar came into the league who at age 32 or age 33 had 1,000 yard seasons. And it's like Adam Thielen, Julian Edelman, Keenan Allen, when he was just funneled targets last year.
Slot receivers too.
Yeah. And I think the other one was, what's his face? DeAndre Hopkins. So four guys, you know, in a 5 or 6 year span, getting to that threshold of like pretty good player. Meanwhile, you can probably find a guy who's 60% as good, 70% as good if you take a swing on a first or second rounder for 10% of the cost. I know that's obviously always a risk with the Ravens draft history for wide receivers, but I think considering the war chest that they have assembled draft capital wise, looking ahead to next year, and that's without even the compensatory picks that they have coming their way, I think probably just that makes the most sense for how they're going to handle their business for players who, as you said, are going for an auction rate salary.
Outstanding. The other big news today, of course, Saleh fired in New York. Lot of discussion about that being the market, the Aaron Rodgers relationship with him. We saw some incredible video evidence of, you know, Saleh trying to give him a hug on the sidelines after a big play, and he pushed him away, which I've just never seen that. I've just never seen anything like it. You heard some of what Woody said today, no doubt. Where do you stand on this? What's how dysfunctional are the Jets?
I think it's someone pointed out, like one of the, I think, fantasy football Twitter users who comes into my timeline every once in a while. I think Sigmund Bloom, who does good work for whatever he does it. Like, you know, what does it say about the Jets that there are divergent reports about whether or not Robert Saleh was being ushered out by security? You
know? Yes.
Like there are obviously pro Saleh camps and anti Saleh camps there, or pro Woody camps and anti Saleh camps, or however, you know, you want to do everything there. I mean, obviously, you know, Joe Douglas should be counting his lucky stars or maybe counting his days until he gets on he faces the execution squad, because it wasn't Saleh's defense that wasn't the trouble there in New York. I mean, I think, you know, Ben Solak for ESPN tweeted earlier after Saleh got the boot that, like, you know, since he arrived there in 2021, they've been like first in EPA per play, first in EPA per drive, you know, first in like third in points per drive, all this incredible stuff. And just the absolute, you know, travesty of quarterbacking that they've had that has left all that go to waste has just been really, really sad. But I guess obviously the thing that Ravens fans should probably prepare for, and I've started thinking about myself, is just, you know, last year's offense was a top five offense. This year's offense is number one DVOA, with passing and rushing being number one. I think we can probably safely say it's going to be, you know, at least a top 10 offense, assuming that Lamar stays healthy. And, you know, coordinators who have that kind of production do not stay coordinators for very long. So I know it's Todd Monken's dream, as it is, I think, for 99% of coordinators in the NFL to get that head coaching job. And if Lamar becomes a two-time MVP, or even just, you know, makes another Pro Bowl, and this offense, you know, continues to show some of the innovative things that they've been doing, and Todd Monken continues to be, you know, the well-liked guy around the locker room, around the facility that he is, then I think, you know, he's absolutely going to be a very hot coaching name. I think, you know, Jeremy Fowler was already throwing his name out there as a potential guy to look out for, as a, you know, candidate who could emerge after all this Jet stuff shakes out, if they are indeed going to go for an outside hire.
You know, it is a byproduct of playing great football, is that your coordinators get other jobs. And I'm not really worried about it. What I'd really be worried about is if the Ravens didn't have a proven ability to continually find and have succession plans for outstanding coordinators. Now, that was not always true in the Harbaugh era. Earlier on, they had some, you know, one-year swing and misses at offensive coordinator that didn't work out. Then they got Kubiak. Marty Morningweg was not great. But Greg Roman, you know, for all of the crap he gets from Ravens fans right now, was an outstanding offensive coordinator who revolutionized the thing. He was the perfect coordinator, frankly, for Lamar for his early years. Then you want to take another step with him. I understand moving on from him and getting somebody else. Monken's a good choice. There are others. And the Ravens will find them. The Ravens will do a good job of finding new coaches. And the fact, I want you to kind of give your opinion on this, but my understanding of Bisciotti's organization is that you don't take power away from the individual silos, and the GM and coach silos are separate, because he really does want to balance a power situation there. And then you have the, you know, the administrative and the presidential silo in terms of team profitability, and the communication silo. But within that football operations silo, that the coaching side maintains all decisions over coaching in the end. So, for instance, when Martindale was hired a few years back, I thought, okay, this is an internal hire, and this is a mistake not to offer this out to the broader, you know, NFL and college population of defensive coordinators out there. Might really bring something new. The Ravens should make this into effectively a head coach search. But to do so would be to neuter the current head coach. So they didn't do it. They went with the succession plan. And I think you'd really be hard pressed to say the Martindale era didn't work out. You could say it got stale. You could say, you could whine about with the too much blitzing, but I think that it was the right call. And it's one of the reasons why the Ravens have been so stable and so good for so long, is that Bisciotti really respects and has an outstanding set of silos with individual areas of authority.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess just to continue along the thread of defensive stability, innovation, excellence. I looked it up, you know, like maybe a month ago or so at this point. It's not fresh in my memory right now, but I think it's something like, you know, maybe 8 of the last 10 years or something, the Ravens have had a top 10 defense in DVOA. And that is just incredible, you know, considering that the most stable thing year to year is, if you have an awesome QB, you're going to have an awesome offense. Like it's always going to be the Chiefs, you know, top five in DVOA. It's always going to be, you know, it's always going to be the Packers top five in DVOA when Aaron Rodgers was doing his thing. I mean, you know, the only thing that you can count on in the NFL from year to year is, if you have a good quarterback, you're going to have a good offense. And John Harbaugh, I think, because of what he's been able to do coaching wise, obviously having good players definitely helped, but you know, I think there was that story in The Athletic this offseason from Ted Wynn, you know, just kind of touching on the Mike Macdonald hire by Seattle and like this quote unquote Raven system where everything that has become, I think, now copied around the league with the, you know, creepers and the simulated pressures and, you know, mugging up the A gap and everything. All of that is just like a accumulation of everything John Harbaugh has picked up along the way from everyone he's, you know, gotten contact with, everyone that he's hired and then learned from as his defensive coordinator, from, you know, Dean Pease to Wink Martindale, you know, Mike Macdonald, obviously, probably being the most famous example now because he actually parlayed all that into a head coaching job and a nice one in Seattle. But I think whatever you want to say about Zach Orr and what he's doing or not doing right now, I think there is so much institutional knowledge that John Harbaugh has. And I know, you know, he's not calling plays. He's not there in the defensive meetings, but there might not be a guy who, you know, is low key more, you know, wise to the trends and what works to bust offenses than John Harbaugh, because he's been around so many different, you know, cutting edge dudes in this league who were really important in pushing the game forward in interesting ways. And I think that is always going to give me confidence that wherever, you know, the next step this team goes defensively, it's probably going to end up going in a pretty good direction. Obviously now having Lamar, I think gives me a lot more comfort that, you know, even if Todd Monken leaves after this year, things will be all right. Because I mean, the left unsaid with Todd Monken leaving is just like how much returning talent, whoever might step into that job, would have. Just like in, especially if they can find a way to keep Ronnie Stanley for another year, that would just be an absolutely dream job setting for whoever the 2024 or 2025 offensive coordinator is. So, yeah, I mean, I know people like to get on John Harbaugh for his clock management and the you know, the playoff shortcomings in recent years and everything, but he is a very curious guy, and I think that's reflected in all of the ways that the offense and defense have morphed over even just like the past 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, let me just point out one additional thing. You're talking about the defense there when you're talking about keeping institutional knowledge, and the Ravens have never had a problem keeping great defensive coordinators around. It's always been largely in-house succession that they've followed in terms of getting the next guy. So it's easier to see why it would be true on that side. But just the transition from Roman to Monken has been not throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's before Henry got here. You know, they had a year where they kept a lot of those Greg Roman run concepts around in the new offense. And it gives you a lot of confidence that they're going to accumulate institutional knowledge and have people who add wrinkles rather than completely toss out the playbook.
Yeah. And hiring guys who aren't too proud to say, yeah, we're keeping the shit that worked from the previous playbook. I mean, I think it might've been like the introductory presser from Todd Monken or one of his first offseason pressers after he was hired, where he was like, yeah, there's a lot of great stuff from Greg Roman that we're going to use. And just in the same way that, you know, the counter bash option plays always seem to get, you know, 5 yards if you needed, if you had a 3rd and 3 or 10 yards if you had like a 2nd and 8 under Giro, it's working like exactly the same way under Todd Monken. So why, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I think Todd Monken, you know, knows that he doesn't need to have his fingerprints all over everything. Because if you have a winning team, I think people are willing to overlook, you know, the reinvention of the wheel. If you are continually putting out a really good product, he definitely has done that.
All right, let's move on. We need to talk about the offense from this game, and we're kind of talked about league stuff and coaching and whatnot, but we'll get right into it now. I think they won the snap battle, of course, 7-7-65 in this game. I think one of the things the Ravens can be really happy about is that they activated 5 defensive linemen for the game. They had long stretches in Q3 where Cincinnati had the ball, where that script completely got flipped in Q4, as we talked earlier. But I thought it was good that they didn't get completely worn out at that point and still had some good playmaking ability left in Q4 that I honestly think is related to having 5 defensive linemen available in part. Because if the Bengals could have suddenly found a way to run the ball, that would have been one of the things that would have really hurt the Ravens in that fourth quarter.
Yeah, I'm racking my brain trying to find a creative way to write about the run defense, because it's obviously just inherently an unsexy proposition. But just looking historically, I think over the past 10 years, I believe I looked at it on True Media, I think they have allowed the third fewest rushing yards over the first five games of any team in that span. I think only like the Vita Vea Bucks during, you know, that mm-hmm. team's heyday allowed fewer, and that was like, you know, 2020 and 2021. So it's I don't know if you've had any of the ESPN, you know, data guys on, you know, on your podcast, Ken, but it is kind of confusing to see this defense be very, very good against the run, and then like only rank, I think they're ranking outside the top 10 in run stop win rate on you know, the ESPN tracking metrics. So I think it was also kind of the case last year where like they were very good against the run, but they didn't really do all that well by how the X's and O's were showing up on like the next gen stats data. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Maybe they just had some good luck with, you know, runners not seeing holes and hitting them or whatever. But I guess it's going to be one hell of a litmus test with Jaden Daniels and his speed and what the Commanders have been doing in the run game. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing there's a lot to like with what this run defense is able to do, and the guys that they have showing up and making contributions. I mean, you know, Brent Urban doing good work. He almost had a sack against Joe Burrow, I think, yep. on Sunday. And, you know, Brody getting into the backfield. Obviously, Travis Jones commands a double team whenever he's out there. So it's been really fun to see those guys just kick ass every week, no matter who they're going against.
Yeah, that Travis Jones-Matt Abike pairing is very fun to watch, because it means Matt Abike gets a single team almost always when Travis Jones is out there with him. And if you look at our score sheet, what we keep, you know, the participation by play, those guys are almost always on for the same plays. And then they'll put in Washington and Pierce for a set of plays, and Urban will get on when it's base defense or occasionally as a replacement for Washington. But you know, is the pairing of Jones and Matt Abike is very consistent. But back to the offense here, Derrick Henry out of the phone booth very late in this game. The Bengals obviously very much sold out to stop the run early. It was visible in multiple reasons. They used not only heavy fronts, they used pass rush fronts, you know, that are sim pressure fronts, which we really need to talk about in more detail later, because they were relentless in terms of their sim pressure. When you show that to the opposition, it immediately takes them out of any run plays. So you show an 8-man front, you're not running the football. There's just too many bodies to get through that. But then they finally got the nice off tackle look they liked. They got it very well blocked up, just like the 87 yarder against Buffalo. Thing of utter beauty in terms of him going untouched as long as he did on that run.
Yeah, it was the blocking on that was very funny, because yeah. Trey Hendrickson sniffs out the crack block from Tylan Wallace, but they end up perfectly exchanging it because Tylan Wallace goes and finds work elsewhere, and Patrick Ricard is the one who takes on 91. And as you said, it's a clear path for Henry. And then was it Ricard or while like there was someone downfield who blocked so well on the perimeter,
Stanley?
It was Stanley who blocked so well downfield that like there is a Bengals safety who has a bead on Henry. I think it might have been Von Bell, and just completely biffs the angle, because I think he's maybe bumped into.
Didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious high potency gummies, top shelf flower, home baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary. You can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide-free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood.
And don't forget to use promo code Ravens when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
By the block that Ronnie makes. And, you know, if there was one guy on that Bengals back end who was going to make that play, I think it was Von Bell or whoever it was who was running free, but just completely bungles it because of the, you know, kind of knockdown effect of guys getting downfield and blocking their asses off. So that was kind of befuddling to see, but it also sort of made sense because when you have guys hustling and doing what they're supposed to downfield, then typically the kind of puck luck, as they say in hockey, tends to go your way.
Puck luck. Okay. I haven't heard it called that, but that's great. So just picking up loose pucks, having a shot at the on net or having a, yeah.
Right.
Okay, good. All right. The one thing that is a little concerning that nobody's really talking about today because of the outcome, I think largely, is the fact that Lamar is putting the ball on the ground a little bit more than we would like. And if you think back to the early years of Lamar, 2018, 2019, both, a lot of fumbles. Now, these fumbles in some ways are worse and they're all him because they didn't have anything to do with an exchange. These were both they were both fumbled snaps, right? Yeah, it was fumbled snaps, then kicked by the kicked by the left guard and that Keystone Cops, you know, McCary to kick it away from him. And then there was, of course, the fumble snap on the amazing play. But where does your level of concern lie with those things? Or do you think that's entirely correctable?
Yeah, I think those are just anomalies in their way. I think if they were mesh point mix-ups, if they were Lamar being a little bit too loose with the ball, you know, in the same way that he was on that Chris Jones strip sack, then I would say that, you know, that is him not being able to fix a bad habit. But I think the fact that they were both, you know, explained the overtime snap issue as like him just looking at the play clock at precisely the wrong time, because it was obviously going down to one, going down to zero. Linderbaum snaps it. It's a perfect snap. And he just doesn't have his eyes on it. So I think obviously that is eminently correctable. And I think it's, I mean, if you were to like set the over under for the number of fumbled snaps over the rest of the season at like 0.5, I would probably take the under.
Oh yeah. I was going to say 1.5. So I was going to say, but then I would probably take the under at 1.5.
Can you remember him fumbling a snap before Sunday?
It's happened before other times when sometimes he hasn't been ready for the snap, but Linderbaum put one that was just to his left or just to his right a little bit that went into the end zone. He had a kick out of the end zone for the safety against the Rams last year. There just have been instances. It's not common, but it does happen.
Yeah.
So, it's one place to look on that is, well, you can look on the fumble rating on PFF and get a sense, or you don't even have to do that. You just look at fumbles in any source and you'll see others. Right. And I think there'd be a couple aborted snaps. Quarterbacks, it's always a quarterback somewhere in the league that leads the league in fumbles. If you've got a running back who's doing it, he doesn't usually last long enough to get the 8 or 9 fumbles it will take to lead the league. I thought the receivers had a really good game. You know, this was, I thought a very important game for Rashad Bateman to break out, get decent separation. We've seen some separation metrics. As soon as I see separation metrics, it almost makes me angry because I immediately want to understand the methodology. At what point are you measuring separation? Is it at the throw? Is it at the break? Is it, you know, because there's a lot of ways that Bateman is going to look better at certain times than at others. And I think actually Bateman's separation probably erodes over time. But I will tell you one thing I really like to see from the Ravens in this game is I think they did a better job than they have so far this year of extending their routes, of really continuing to run their routes. And that's a good thing because this is a lot of extended plays in this game for Lamar.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There were
Bateman had one on the touchdown, likely on the touchdown, actually stopped running the route, but then he started again.
Yeah, I mean, to me on Bateman, that was like, I don't know if he was the first read on that, but that was like I don't think that was a situation where he was ever going to just stop in the middle of the field. Like that was a, you know, kind of a, it wasn't a mesh concept, but it was like a, you know, a bunch of crossing routes that tried to mess with whatever Cincinnati was doing. Obviously they didn't know that they would go cover zero or, you know, cover one or whatever it was with the guys dropping from the line. But I don't think it was an accident that Bateman found his way to the right side of the field. I don't think he expected to be completely wide open, but that was just, you know, Lamar doing what he had to, feeling that pressure fading, which I think he's done really well, you know, fading from the pressure, but still being able to keep his eyes downfield. I think he had the really nice throw against, who was it? Maybe it was Dallas or Buffalo, where, you know, he's been able to kind of drift back like 10 yards from the line of scrimmage and still be able to throw it 15 yards downfield as he's about to get hit. And I think this was obviously a much easier throw. If you actually go back and look at the all 22 of that 16 yard touchdown, I think like three of the four guys who go out on that route do get open for would-be touchdowns, but the easiest guy to throw to was Bateman. Lamar finds him. And you know, that was, it was good to see. I think Bateman is one touchdown away from setting a career high for a season, which is a funny stat, but also I think, you know, heartwarming, because I don't know if there's anyone that I'm rooting for more than Bateman, just because I think he's awesomely talented and just a great guy. And it's been really exciting to see him finally catch on in this offense.
I'd be happy to see it happen. Obviously, he's a guy, I think, who could retreat into his shell and be very unhappy with the situation, the position he was put into in terms of the contract, you know, probably blaming his agent for it in part. He certainly fired his agent over the fact that
I think a couple times
he reported like, oh, did he get the same agent back or did he get a different agent? And he fired somebody new.
No, I think like he's on his like third agency since he entered the NFL or something.
All right. Well, the entire thing of showing up late to camp ended up costing him a lot of money, and he knows it. And it's, you know, he's obviously here playing for the Ravens, and then he's in a situation where he's not getting a lot of targets, and they're running the ball like crazy for 2 weeks. Now finally, he has a breakout game at kind of the peak of the Davante Adams speculation, which that's exactly who gets replaced, by the way, folks. It's not a big surprise, not a big secret about, you know, who gets a very significantly lower snap share if Davante Adams is here. It's Bateman, because Davante Adams is an X, and that's where he'd play.
Yeah. It was a... I guess I didn't realize how different, like, I think, can you probably remember like Rashad talking about how Davante was one of his role model receivers, like a guy who he's patterned his game after. But I didn't realize until I was looking at their player profile pages on ESPN that like Bateman, I think, is listed as 6'1", 195. And then Davante Adams is 6'1", 215. So I had no idea that, I mean, obviously I know that Bateman is a slender for wide receiver, but I had no idea that it was like 20 pounds of difference. And maybe that explains why, you know, Davante has been a better, you know, obviously Lamar isn't the kind of throw it up back shoulder throw type guy that Davante has had over his career. And maybe Bateman can make, you know, would be able to make those kind of throws if, you know, if he got that kind of volume. But it was surprising to me that those two guys who are noted for their route running have very different body types just in terms of their overall thickness. And maybe that explains why, you know, one is an elite receiver and the other guy is just at this point in his career, only a good one.
Yeah. And they both certainly have the reputation of being great route runners, and Bateman, he legitimately is that. I just feel like his value as a route runner has been really mitigated by the fact that Lamar does not like to throw to a receiver he doesn't already see is open. He just does not throw timing routes well, does not throw back shoulder throws at all. It's Flacco's bread and butter. You know, if you had Joe Flacco, he'd remorselessly throw that ball before your break, expect you to get your head around, have your hands up and catch that football. But it's not Lamar's game, and it reduces Bateman's value undeniably, I think, in the Baltimore offense, which is, it's unfortunate for him, but hopefully he can make the best of a bad situation and still become a good player here.
Yeah. I think we could probably talk about this a little bit more when we get to the individual player breakdowns, but I think there was like a stat that, you know, Lamar has thrown into tight windows at the lowest rate of any qualifying quarterback in the NFL. And it kind of makes sense that he's been able to, I don't want to say get away with that, but have that be a sustainable metric or a sustainable pattern for success, because you look at the, you know, again, the ESPN analytics, and they have their open score, which basically measures how well are you separating. And again, I don't know their methodology. I think it's far more it's far more comprehensive than just like, what is your separation when you're targeted? Because that is kind of a hollow statistic, because that means that it's ignoring all the other times that you ran routes and, you know, maybe weren't able to separate. But if you just separate, if you sort by wide receivers on the ESPN analytics site, Rashad Bateman is number 10 in overall open score, and right behind him is Zay Flowers. So that Lamar has two of the, you know, 12 best quote unquote route running wide receivers in the NFL, I think explains why, you know, he's been able to have some of the really great success that he's had, you know, in maybe years when he hasn't had that kind of separation. And, you know, if Mark Andrews can get up to speed, if Isaiah Likely can keep doing his thing, I think it might not matter that the Ravens don't have like even an A- receiver at this level, because if you have a team full of, you know, B- to B+, then that is a very, very scary thing for a defense.
Okay. Now, relating to what you just said, I need to feed you some statistics here, because Lamar having great receivers and making use of it, and it really explains success, I don't think that's really how I would turn it. So 2024, the tight ends have been targeted 41 times, 31 receptions, 398 yards, 4 TDs, no interceptions, 138.1 passer rating. Since the beginning of 2023 in the regular season, that passer rating is 143.2 with 16 touchdowns and zero interceptions going to the tight ends. Okay. Running backs this year, 24 targets, 23 receptions, 218 yards, 2 TDs, no interceptions, 132.3 rating. So the only other eligible receiver group is wide receivers, and they haven't been bad by any stretch. 70 targets, 45 receptions, 591 yards, 3 touchdowns, 1 interception, 99.2 rating. So it really has been the tight ends and the running backs that have fueled the Ravens passing game. Obviously, we've seen a lot of great yak delivered by Kolar, by Hill in a big way in terms of what he's done, by Henry on the couple passes he's caught. And we've seen, you know, I think more average distance targets from Likely this year and more clutch touchdown targets as well. But it's amazing that it's again the tight ends. And I look at this and I've seen, you know, they had 106 targets, and I used the PFF numbers when I calculated it today again in 2023, because I think I remembered it being 105 last time I looked at it. But it's 41 targets in 2024 so far. And the year before this day, 2022, they threw the ball to Andrews alone like some ridiculous number of times, like 180 times or something, or maybe it was all tight ends were 190 all put together. It's incredible to me the amount that that the offense still relies on the tight end here.
Yeah, I mean, you line up in 22 personnel and 12 personnel and 21 yeah. personnel as often as they do, and they lean into the under center passing game and the easy yeah. targets that it's ginned up for all these guys. It's not a big surprise.
Yeah, that has been a very big part of increasing under center targets. I saw one of the PFF guys was saying that they were on pace to more than double their under center snaps, and they've done that effectively. They've run out of play action. I don't honestly think their play action is particularly tricky. And you watch the Bengals go against them, and one of the things about the play action they find is the Bengals don't even let the boot occur. They're in their two first. So we're about to write down zone block left, naked boot right on our offensive line score sheet, and Lamar can't even escape the pocket. He doesn't even have time to get out of the pocket. They're in there so quickly. So that edge defender very keyed in on Lamar for the Bengals. The Bengals obviously very, you know, if you watch this game, they blitz Lamar a ton, both in terms of numbers and in terms of some other. A variation of scheme, but the play action was still effective. It's just Lamar is not really a very frequent straight drop play action guy, which is something I wish they would do more out of pistol. I'd like to get your thoughts on that too, by the way.
Sure. And actually, just to rewind the conversation a little bit, I'm just looking at some True Media stuff, Ken, right now. It is totally in agreement with what you were saying about Lamar targeting tight ends and running backs. You know, when Lamar's targeted a running back, his EPA per dropback is 0.44, which is like well above what an MVP needs to, or what a player needs to win an MVP. When he's targeting a tight end, it is 0.52. So even better, by the way, the only person ahead of him, obviously not, this isn't excluding all non-qualifiers, but the only guy ahead of him is Joe Flacco at a ridiculous 1.17. So I'm sure he's had some insane games, like targeting Mo Alie-Cox or whatever tight ends are on that Colts roster. But when you filter for wide receivers, it is admittedly a bit of a drop off, but still EPA per dropback when he's targeting a wide receiver, 0.25. That's like
perfectly fine.
It's 12th in the NFL among, you know, however true media is sorting these guys by qualifier. And, you know, I guess I would say that there's probably always going to be that delta between the groups, because the throws that you would funnel to wide receivers are some of the throws that Lamar has struggled the most with. Obviously, those are also the throws that have the biggest bang for their buck when they do hit. But it's like I think Lamar's become a really good sideline passer, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of the hits that the strikes that he made against Cincinnati. But I'm talking more so about the nine balls and stuff that, you know, he's either overthrown or thrown off to the side, and, you know, those are the plays that just don't really do anything for this, that Lamar has struggled completing and haven't really done a whole lot for this offense. But it's good to see, I think, you know, Zay and Bateman becoming at least a very, very solid 1-2 punch of wide receiver that teams just like can't worry about. I was going to say can't worry about going cover zero with, because obviously Cincinnati tried their luck with that, and it didn't go so well for them. But I think the fact that they've become a respectable tandem, I think, does a lot to lift the ceiling or lift the floor and the ceiling of this offense.
How did you read the locker room after the game in terms of how the receivers had? I mean, everybody had a happy. I don't doubt that for a second. But how much of a weight was maybe lifted off the receivers for them having a game that was more focused on them than it had been the previous weeks?
To be honest, there wasn't a whole lot of questions about just like how, you know, the mouths being fed. You know, like I was talking with my colleague Gianna earlier today, and she, like, you know, she went into the locker room right away as opposed to hanging by the presser just so she could, you know, talk to the players. And she said, wait, did no one ask Derrick Henry about, you know, hitting 10,000 career rushing yards? And I was like, no, not really. I mean, there was a lot that happened in that game. And so even though we got Zay at the podium, it was just like questions about the craziness of the fourth quarter and of overtime and of Lamar and of, you know, winning in Cincinnati and just all the dramatics. And it wasn't so much about, you know, the admittedly big game that he had or his kind of role. And, you know, I didn't see Rashad Bateman in there when we got in there. Obviously, we talked to Charlie Kohler and Mark Andrews about, you know, their big days, but it wasn't, other than Kohler, it wasn't, you know, there weren't really a lot of questions about how the kind of target rates had shaken out the way that they had. So hopefully we'll, you know, get a chance to talk to Bateman and Zay in the locker room this week, just to get a sense for where their mood is. But not a whole lot of, you know, temperature readings for me on how they were doing, besides just kind of what you see on Instagram and social media, which is obviously very complimentary, very ecstatic about just how that game had ended.
Right. All right, let's move on to Lamar Jackson here. We're kind of way behind here. I apologize for that, but I kind of got a cut bait on some topics here. Lamar didn't break a lot of runs as a scrambler, but I thought it was very interesting how the Bengals rushed him in this game. And I'm going to go through with some numbers on this, but they had 15 times where they showed Lamar simulated pressure at the line of scrimmage. I can only tell you that's an unbelievable number of times for one football game.
Yeah.
I mean, we have seen it occasionally with like the 40 cover zero looks that Miami gave to Lamar in 2021. That was just a, we're going to continue to do it until you stop it. And most of those were simulated pressure in a sense, because they were dropping two interior defensive linemen from the line, you know, to have some faux coverage responsibility. So you're dropping Adam Butler from the line of scrimmage. That's not a, you're not getting a lot of value out of your nose tackle in terms of coverage, but you, but it is still simulated pressure. These are all the times they dropped two plus. There were a bunch of times they dropped one. And I don't include ones in simulated pressure if it's a one from the A gap and it's a Smith dropping. It really is a simulated pressure in some sense. If it's a one with an outside linebacker dropping, the Sam linebacker in particular dropping to cover a tight end, it's not really a simulated pressure in the same sense that I think about it. But this was just ridiculous. And honestly, it kind of befuddled Lamar. Those 15 plays only went for 82 total yards, 5.5 yards per play. And you look at Lamar's overall day, this was a slice of not particularly savory goodness out of it.
Yeah, it was kind of like the Bengals' defensive strategy was disorienting for me to decipher, not because it was ineffective, but like, when I got to halftime and, you know, had some time to look at the stats and sorted like Lamar by when he was blitzed and by when he wasn't blitzed. And at halftime, True Media was showing that he'd just been blitzed twice. And I was like, there's no way that is freaking true. Like,
but they mean like five plus.
My eyes. Yeah. What's up?
They mean five plus, I think, in the first half is what they're talking about. So I look it up.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. Like the amount of bodies that Cincinnati had shown at the line of scrimmage in that first half, and then just, you know, dropping guys out while you have edge rushers or safeties or, you know, slot cornerbacks coming from the side. I guess it, you know, according to True Media, which I think was using PFF data, they only sent five or more pass rushers after Lamar in that first half twice,
which, seven times.
You know, very okay.
Okay. Yeah, I chart that. So it's
seven times.
Yeah.
that seems more likely. Than just the two that True Media was showing. But to your point, Ken, I remember seeing this tweet from Robert Mays of The Athletic, and, you know, The Athletic football podcast. This was at 2:15 PM, so I guess toward the end of that first half. On a week five preview, mentioned the Bengals leaning into simulated pressures / dropping guys from the line of scrimmage against Lamar Jackson. Per Next Gen Stats, they dropped someone from the line on 66.7% of Lamar's dropbacks today. For context, Minnesota, which obviously has like a just mad scientist scheme there with Brian Flores, leads the league at 49%. So you're talking about 17 points higher than the craziest defensive scheme in the NFL. And
and you're saying that was a 2:15, right?
Other times didn't. Pardon me?
That was at 2:15. So that's the first, first half, maybe even halfway through the first half. I'm going to tell you, they greased it up like nobody's business in the second half. Now they had some crazy things. They had when I talk about a pass rush and I call some a 4-4 pass rush, that means the team showed eight at the line of scrimmage and dropped four of them. Okay. Or they dropped four from the line of scrimmage and they might have blitzed an extra player is the other possibility. But anyway, they dropped four from the line of scrimmage. In the first half, they had a 4-4, a 3-4, a 4-3, a 4-3, a 5-2, a 5-2, and that's it. And then the second half, it got better. They had a 3-2, a 3-2, a 4-2, a 6-2, a 6-2, a 4-3, a 5-2, a 4-4, a 4-3, and that's it. But it was relentless in terms of their desire to drop guys from the line of scrimmage and confuse the line. I think they felt like they were being successful with it. They did get a decent ratio of pressures to ample time and space opportunities on Lamar, about 1.5 to 1, 20 to 13. But I'm a little surprised. To me, it seemed like it was a lot worse in the second half. And I look at it right now, maybe it wasn't that much more different in the second half, but it was fairly relentless in terms of what they did.
Yeah, I mean, did your charting show that they picked up their actual blitz rate in that second half?
So an off-ball blitz rate, or the 5-6-7 or rushing five plus.
The actual rate of them, right, sending five or more guys after Lamar from the first half to the second half.
Seven in the first half and a total of 18 for the game. So they did 11 times in the second half. I couldn't really tell you the number of pass plays first half, second half, right, to tell you that different, but I don't think, right, it's that much. I don't think it was that much different.
Okay.
I'll give you the numbers rush for first. They rushed three times, 6 yards, 2.0 yards per play. They rushed 421 times, allowed 7.4 yards per play. That's where they got their one sack, was on a 4-man rush. So all these five pluses resulted in 0 sacks. The 5-man rush, they did 11 times, 126 yards, 11.5 yards per play. So you think they'd stop that at some point. With six, they rushed him six times, 57 yards, 9.5 yards per play. Seven, one time incomplete, eight, one time incomplete. So, they didn't have great success with the blitz in this game by any stretch. They were a lot weaker trying to blitz Lamar. It's interesting. I was on a show in Cincinnati doing a kind of a know your foe segment on the radio there. And right, they asked me about Lamar under pressure. And they said, is Lamar handling pressure okay? And I said, well, honestly, Lamar's been very much up and down in his career in terms of handling pressure. He's been good at times, he's been bad at times. But, this is a year where certainly he's had some good moments. I think the host on that show really believed that the Bengals would go after Lamar. And I think that, is a reasonable thought. And I think they in a lot of ways, with their secondary the way it is, maybe they felt like they had to do it. I just don't think it worked in this particular game.
Yeah, I mean, just for the season, it looks like Lamar's top 10 in EPA per dropback when pressured. It's obviously a very low number, because as with any quarterback, they get dramatically worse when they are pressured. It looks like only five quarterbacks right now in the NFL have positive EPA per dropback when pressured, and somehow Baker Mayfield is one of them. Actually, even more confusingly, Jalen Hurts is also one of them, considering just how terrible he was against the blitz last year. But yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I was really interested in writing about, and I did write about before the season, was just on Lamar and his command of the offense before the snap, and his ability to can calls and changes to the protection responsibilities and everything like that. And everyone on that in that locker room who I talked to on the offense was like, oh yeah, this is a new and improved version of Lamar. He's way more in command. He's a lot more comfortable and confident in what he's doing. And I think you see that. I did a story today, just like kind of like an unscientific ranking of Lamar's 10 best plays from the Sunday game. And I kind of cheated and included two plays as my second place entry, and they were both the completions to Zay Flowers, like midway through the fourth quarter. There was like the 16 yarder and the 22 ish yarder. They happened like within a three play span of one another. But on the first one, he motions, he sees the cover zero pre-snap look. He motions Mark Andrews over from the wide alignment into the protection so that he can, chip on, I think it was Geno Stone, actually, hang up his own coverage defender, obviously, and then leak out into the flat. And he hits Zay Flowers for a nice sideline completion, I think on second and 12, which goes for first down. And then two plays later, again, another cover zero pre-snap look. He doesn't change anything, but he does, he does leave his perch in the shotgun to say some things to the offensive line, maybe sorting out responsibilities. He also, motions or gestures or something to Isaiah Likely, who looks back at him. I don't know if Isaiah Likely was always going to stay in and block and chip, but he does for this one. And that leads to Lamar having enough time and space to hit Zay on that outbreaking route for the 15 or 16 yards again on second and 10 for a nice first down. And a couple of plays later, they I think that's the drive that ends with the touchdown pass to Isaiah Likely. So I think they're probably at least two dozen examples of plays like that where Lamar has said something correctly and pointed out something intuitively at the line of scrimmage, and maybe ways that Todd Monken or Greg Roman couldn't trust him to do that in previous years. But just having the confidence in your quarterback and empowering him to make decisions like that, I think absolutely pays off in games like this against defensive coverages against defensive schemes as kind of radical and, you know, balls to the wall as this one.
You know, both of those plays you're mentioning now, there were two plays apart, 17 and 12 yards. They're both 6'2 pass rushers. So in both those cases, the Bengals showed eight. And Lamar, obviously, in terms of what you're describing, and I'm not remembering what he did exactly on the plays, but he had to be going up and decoding that that pass rush to try and help the lineman get it. You know, it's oftentimes when teams show simulated pressure like that, they're really trying to confuse the line as much as the quarterback. The line is actually the group that can end up giving away a free runner because the blocking assignments aren't working out together in terms of picking up the right guys. Another guy who I thought really helped in this game, had a terrible pass blocking grade from PFF, is Justice Hill, who I thought was terrific in the role. He was battling his ass off as a pass blocker, I thought, in this game. And I had some very unfavorable assignments, some of it from misses at the line of scrimmage, some failed pickups at the line of scrimmage, which puts him in a very bad position. And I'll say, you know, you can do a set blocker or a chip blocker. Set blocker stays in for the play. Chip blocker, you know, runs a route afterwards. The chip blocking assignment's almost always hit and go kind of thing, say, or hit and run kind of thing. That it's not, you're not ever usually assigned with the responsibility for the play. The set blocking responsibility is where you might really have to pick up something that's very important that's left over by a lineman or is an extra free runner. He was just, I thought, marvelous in that role. It was almost like the way he was struggling, I think it was in the Kansas City game, right, to block Chris Jones, and Lamar kind of gave him a chance I mean, I thought he had a great game.
He wasn't struggling. He was doing a good job in spite the fact that he was going against a 330-pound total beast.
Yeah. No, exactly right. Exactly right.
I forget, Ken, if I had made this point to you during a previous recording, but like I have such admiration for Justice Hill and his blocking ability. And just like, I know there were so many inflection points in that, not the week one game against Kansas City, but the AFC Championship game against Kansas City. Like if they'd gotten a normal Justice Hill pass blocking game in that one, you know, you can point fingers at Zay Flowers for the fumble. You can point fingers at, you know, Kyle Hamilton for giving up the touchdown to Travis Kelce. But like, there were so many plays where if Justice Hill, not so many, but they were like, there were a couple plays where if Justice Hill had done this and been normal, had a B minus game as a pass blocker, we might be talking about like the Ravens as Super Bowl champions, because he just picked the absolute worst times to whiff on a block or not pick up someone. And it just seemed like it, you know, bit the Ravens in the ass at exactly the wrong time. And I feel so bad. I don't think a lot of people, you know, spent their offseason cursing out Justice Hill for not being like, you know, this unflinching pass blocker, but I'm sure it probably rankles him. And I think it's such an important part of this Ravens offense, considering how teams have wanted to defend Lamar, that if you can have someone be reliable, which he has been, I think, throughout the season, but unfortunately he wasn't in the AFC Championship game. It's just kind of like a very small sliding doors moment for me that I think about whenever I see him doing as good a job as I think he was doing against Cincinnati.
Yeah, it was a night and day game from Justice Hill the previous week. Why don't we leave that for the next episode? I want to hit on Lamar's passing statistics in one more way. Then we got to move on and we'll handle all the rest in part two. But ample time and space BOQ pressure is makes up the opportunity set for the quarterback here. Lamar had 13 ample time and space opportunities, about 30%. That's a normal amount. Only got the ball out quickly 10 times. That was a much higher percentage of Burrow's throws in this game, was getting the ball out quickly. But 20, as you would expect, but 23% Lamar had the ball out quickly. And he was pressured on 47% of plays. It's damn good he had a good pressure game this week, because he gave up, he still threw for 6.4 yards per play with pressure, when 3.5 is about average. That's kind of the standard I use for that. Right. 10 ball out quicks, average is about 6.0. He did 9.2, and 13 ATS opportunities. Again, not bad in terms of the offensive line providing him that, 9.7 yards per play, when about 8.5 would be about what I'd expect. So it's not like he way overproduced in that way. Overall, He also ran them out of two pressures, by the way, which aren't even in the denominator here. But he overpassed his opportunity set by 104 yards, 345 net yards, 241 expected. So that includes all the value of sacks and some things you don't see in passer rating necessarily. But in terms of just of his yards, and it does not take into account the turnovers, it was a fantastic day for him. Unfortunately, Burrow was plus 140 in this game.
Yep, and they still lost somehow.
Yeah, just, there you go. All right. Well, I'll tell you what.
Go again.
I want to let you make your point because we have to wrap up the first show, and we'll come back in a second. I'm sorry. Please respond to that. I want to give you a chance before we move on.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was just going to say, it was funny to see in light of all the glowing tributes to Lamar that were written and said aloud after Sunday's game, including by yours truly, to see him not even make the top five of the PFF grades. Because of the weird start that he had to this game, missing, was it Zay who was wide open in the flat on that play action bootleg, and then there's the throw where he almost tries to give the Bengals interception on the throw to Kohler in the first or second quarter. Unfortunately, Charlie's able to track that and get a hand on it and disrupt it. And then obviously the two fumbles, I'm sure, did him no favors, but it just kind of one of those weird things where you have the cognitive dissonance between knowing that this dude just had a Hall of Fame worthy type performance, and then not seeing it reflected in the PFF grades in the same way that, when Lamar was, back in 2019, setting the NFL single season record for rushing yards by a quarterback, I think his PFF rushing grade was only 74 or something come on, guys. At least give the guy a little bit of credit for being the best to ever do it in a single season.
PFF has always been very direct. That's why I love having their analytics guys and their R&D guys on the show. So always been very open about what their system doesn't really handle or where they are aware of some weightings that aren't really correct. But one of the big ones that their previous R&D head, and this is Eric Eager, if you know the name, if people have heard that name before, but he said that he was fully aware that the grading system did not reflect what Lamar was doing for the other players on the field. And so, we're just not capturing that. Yes, you might be capturing his running reasonably well. And, they're doing a good job. I mean, the grading is consistent. It's one of the really nice things about PFF is, you can fairly well trust it across multiple teams to be showing you the same thing. I don't agree with every component of offensive line scoring. I've made that clear over the years. We won't go into that. Right. But on the other hand, they're really good at being consistent about things. It's just, I think there are things that are missing, and I don't think they're alone in failing to recognize Lamar's value to the other 10 players. I think one of the big guys who missed it is Aaron Schatz. It was the lone dissenter among the MVP voters last year. Really does not appreciate that concept. He just does not appreciate that concept. Love the guy, does not appreciate that concept.
Yeah. I know he talked to our columnist, Kyle Yoon, for a story that Kyle wrote after Aaron Schatz, credit to him, outed himself as the lone dissenter. He love Aaron and all the stuff that he does with DVOA. Wish the FTN site was had some of the functionality of the Football Outsiders days, but grateful to his contributions to the football discourse. So I'm not going to say too many bad words about a guy like that, but obviously for him to be a Lamar, not hater, because he's definitely not a hater, but to not maybe contextualize what Lamar's able to do in light of, the Josh Allen of it all, the Dak Prescott of it all, it was a little bit, I guess, disappointing.
Yeah. All right. Jonas, always a pleasure to talk football with you. We've gone way over in this episode. In fact, we're going to have to push some things to episode two. But tell folks where they can talk football with you online and where they can, of course, see you work with the banner.
Yeah, Jonas _ Schaefer on Twitter /X, JonasShaffer. TheBaltimoreBanner.com. Just $1 for, I think, 6 months. I'm hopeful to have a cool project that I've been working on. Watched every single Derrick Henry carry over his career over the past week and a half or so to just chart all of his stiff arms. So that was something that I did, and we're still trying to figure out exactly how it's going to look in the online. But yeah, some pretty cool stuff about who he hit the most, what hand he did it with, you know, when he's been most stiff arm prone. Probably not as stiff arm prone as you might think, considering, you know, his reputation as this physical downhill runner, but still pretty cool to go back and see how, you know, he's evolved over the years as a runner from Tennessee and now Baltimore.
That is a fantastic project. And you know what, as an analytics guy, the thing I love is the universality of what you did. So you looked at all of his runs, not just give me 10 stiff arms and you talk to a Tennessee writer and they can tell you, well, in the third quarter, he had this long run. And that's the worst way to do it. But what you did, that's great. If you're starting from the whole universe and going back and finding, I'll be very interested to read that. Jonas,
do you want to take a shot in the dark at the one Raven who got stiff armed in all the Derrick Henry?
There's only one
battle axe years.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Because we're excluding, we're not counting for one plays that were called back because of penalties, but also no playoff games. So Earl Thomas, wherever you are safe.
My guess is it probably happened in 20 in a defensive lineman.
Yep.
Okay. It probably happened in 2020 in the game at Baltimore during, or 2021, right? During COVID.
Yep.
The COVID game. Yeah. And I'm going to say it was, so Pierce wasn't here. Madubuike was a rookie, right? No. Yeah. Madubuike was a rookie. Mm-hmm. No. Madubuike was on the team. It could have been Madubuike. I'll just guess him. Who was it?
Derek Wolfe.
Derek Wolfe.
He got Derrick Henry's right hand on a run for 11 yards that Malik Harrison stopped in the fourth quarter. That was the fourth quarter when, like, I think that was the if I'm remembering correctly, the Ravens had completely, like, shut down Derrick Henry for the first three quarters of that game, but hadn't done enough on offense to put the game away. And then slowly but surely, Derrick Henry got rolling, and they, I think, won that game in overtime, right?
They did. They on a Derrick Henry touchdown run, long one of 30 yards or something. He broke one. All right. Other folks out there, thanks for listening. First of all, it's been a very long episode. Really appreciate that. If you're the sort of loyal listener who's still on this this time, please hit like and subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. If you're not, show the podcast to a friend or give us a 50-word review on Twitter on your favorite podcast platform. That'll help drive some traffic here. We really appreciate that. Jonas, thanks again for coming on.
Of course, Ken.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Flurries of fun await this winter in Indiana. Feel the rush of the Midwest's only refrigerated toboggan run. Ski down snow-covered slopes and marvel at frozen waterfalls on a winter hike. When it's time to unwind, from outdoor fun to indoor escapes, your perfect winter getaway starts in Indiana. Plan your trip today at inindiana.com/winter.